$1 billion on food every year. You know how much of that gets back to the farmers? They clear about $69 billion of that. Okay, it's a tiny, tiny amount, and $14 billion of what they're clearing is subsidies. Just to give you an idea, the people who make the packages, the cellophane and the cardboard, they're clearing $69 billion. They're making more money than the farmers are. Okay, we're spending more money on the packages our food comes from than on the farmers. So we can't expect them to drive this change. That's too much to ask. It's really that $770 billion of food marketing, food processing, which is to say convenience eating. The farmers are not the decision makers here. To a large extent, it's about policy and it's about us. And that means changing our behavior. We need to enlist more people in this movement, and that's why I think what Michelle Obama is doing is so important. We need to begin with our children. Alice Waters really got this one right. The fact is that the way you begin to change the food culture is teach children how to grow food, how to cook food, and how to eat food. Now, that might sound a little paternalistic, that our schools should be teaching children how to eat, and that strikes parents as odd. But make no mistake, we're teaching them how to eat right now. If you give kids for lunch chicken nuggets and tater tots and 10 minutes to eat them in, you are teaching them very effectively how to become a fast food consumer for the rest of their lives. So we need to teach them in a different way. So I think reform of school lunch, which is very much on the agenda this year, the school lunch reauthorization is coming up, is vitally important. We need to bring back home ec. We need to make, as Alice Waters says, make lunch an academic subject. I think she's absolutely right about that. Now, we also need to teach adults, because a great many adults are not aware that they're eating fossil fuel. They think they're eating hamburgers and french fries. And you could see how they might make that mistake. It looks more like hamburgers and french fries than fossil fuel. So we have to make it look a little more like oil. And the way you do that, I think, is you put a second calorie count on every package of processed food. That there are, 60 calories of food energy in this head of lettuce or whatever it is, and 160 calories of fossil fuel energy. So you can know at a glance, are you eating something that took more fossil fuel energy than solar energy to deliver to you? And if we put that on every food package, at least those people who care would be educated about what's really going on. We need much more. That's one example of a whole raft of measures to make the food system more transparent. The fact is, people really are deeply disconnected from where their food comes from, and it's very hard to find out. The products all lie. There are, images of farms and pastoral scenery on the packages that really are coming from feedlots. When the food system gets this long and this opaque, it's very hard to know what kind of system you're really supporting, and consumers are deeply confused. So I think we need to move toward a system where there will be a second barcode on every product. I know I'm crowding these labels. And that you could run that barcode under a scanner at a kiosk in the supermarket, and there would come an image of the farm where that chicken actually lived. This is no longer expensive at all. And you would see the diet. You press another button and see the diet. What did that chicken eat? What pharmaceuticals went into that chicken? And then you press another button and you see the slaughterhouse. And nothing would clean up those awful places faster than cameras broadcasting through the web to eaters on a 24/7 basis. So we should be fighting for transparency. The principle of the glass abattoir, the glass wall in the slaughterhouse, will be more powerful than any regulation you could dream up. And then, of course, we need, and I proposed this in Farmer-in-Chief and have been very happy to see that it's actually happening, is that the White House set an example. And Michelle Obama has begun to do that. We have a White House organic garden, which is, very... Who thought that this would actually happen? Except for Alice Waters, actually. But I never thought it would really happen. You know, this sounds symbolic, but if you go back to World War II, when Eleanor Roosevelt did the same thing, we got to a point where there were 20 million Victory Gardens in America in World War II, and they provided 40% of the produce in this country. We have this huge resource called the Great American Lawn. And to the extent we can rip that out and begin growing food, that is the most local food of all. That is the shortest food chain of all. The freshest, most nutritious, and often tastiest food that you can possibly grow. But gardening is very, very important for other reasons too. And I'm going to end on this point and talk a little bit more about politics perhaps when we sit down. Because gardens teach a different way of being in the world. A tremendous part of our problem, I think, confronting climate change today is that we all feel helpless. It's too big a problem, and our lives are just too deeply woven into this system of what Wendell Berry called the cheap energy mind. By that he meant we do so little for ourselves today. We depend on distant others to feed us, to entertain us, to do our taxes, to do everything. And it's cheap fossil fuel that allowed us to have this incredible division of labor. It has underwritten some good things. But the challenge of living without cheap fossil fuel is the challenge of doing more for ourselves. And the wonder of gardening is the discovery that doing something more for yourselves is eminently doable, eminently pleasurable, makes you feel empowered. And I think that finally is what's driving this whole food movement. It is one area of our lives where we can take back power from the cheap energy culture. And even if it's incremental, even if it's in parts, but we see how we can do it. We don't see how we can live without our cars, without our heat, without our air conditioning, but we can change the way we eat and begin, really, to tackle these problems one delicious bite at a time. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Got some questions?
Yes, we do. I think we had more questions than we've ever had.
That means I left some things unanswered.
While you were talking, I was thinking of the Amish. I have a particular interest in the Amish, and in many ways, they would satisfy a lot of your concerns of this model of bringing animals back onto the farm. And what's interesting about the Amish is that they're producing it themselves at a great rate, and they're buying up farmland. Are they a solution to the labor problem?
This is a trap.
No,
Kevin.
It's not.
You know, Wendell Berry talks a lot about the Amish, and many of his examples of really good farming are Amish. The Amish are terrific farmers. They show what you can do with small amounts of land, sometimes really not great land, and how much food you can produce without, you know, all the technologies of modern agriculture. But I tend to think that the future of agriculture is not about turning back the clock. And the kinds of agriculture that excite me are not pre-industrial, they're post-industrial. And so what someone like Joel Salatin is doing with these very complex rotations of animals depends on a knowledge of entomology, soil science, botany, energy flows that simply was unavailable until very recently. And so to hold up the Amish as an example, even though I think there are many things to be learned from them, and Wendell Berry has translated a lot of those lessons, is to suggest that we need to turn back the clock, and I don't think that's what's in store.
Okay. So you talked about the kind of post-industrial solution. So Anthony Cagle, I think that is. What is the role of robotics in relocalizing agriculture?
That's a good one. Well, you know, one of the when you look at a monoculture, you realize it's tied to a certain kind of technology. Which is to say, the big combine, the 32-row planter, these are amazing devices. Mm-hmm. And monoculture seems to favor that kind of simple one-solution technology. But I was talking to an agronomist at Iowa State when I was researching Omnivore's Dilemma, and he said, you know, that fit was true once, but it needn't be true now. And there is no reason that we shouldn't be able to develop a mechanical picker that could handle something like the Three Sisters rotation of the Mexican rotation of corn, squash, and beans. And things ripening at different times that, you know, if they can build cars, they can recognize when the tomato is ripe, when the bean is ripe, and actually sort their way through that complicated little ecosystem going on there. So, you know, it's a high capital solution, but I think that we are at a moment where we could start reconceiving our hardware in agriculture to deal with polyculture. So if he'll fund it, I'll support it.
Fred, no last name. Cheap food is also very convenient and fast. Eating real food requires time and effort. Given our time-obsessed society, how do we affect what is a huge behavioral change?
Well, that's the cultural shift I'm talking about. I mean, we put very little time into food in this country. It's something like a half hour a day for procuring food, preparing food, and eating food. That's the average. Isn't that amazing how little time it is? This used to occupy many, many hours. And most people feel they don't have any more time to give to food. I find this kind of stunning. I mean, in the last 10 years alone, we found 2 hours a day to deal with the internet. You know, the day is still 24 hours. There's no more time in the day. Now, we're stealing this from our employers in many cases, I think. But we could steal a little online food shopping, too. So I really think it is, for many people, about priority. And I know we have, you know, we have two-income households, and it is more of a struggle. But we spend a lot of time waiting in restaurants for our food to be prepared. And if you throw that time in, that time could be spent cooking.
There are a number of questions about your kind of avoidance of the issue of genetically engineered food. And particularly as you were suggesting that you're not interested in looking back, but going forward. Mm-hmm. So what's wrong with genetically engineering crops to produce the kinds of things that we want in whatever direction that we want to go?
Well, I can imagine genetically modified crops that would contribute to the kind of sustainable agriculture that I'm describing. We don't have them now. And they're not, and by and large, they're not being worked on. I mean, Pam Ronald may tell you something else when she comes here, but basically, technologies don't operate in isolation. They're contextual, and the context of the big GM crops we have today are monocultures. They are designed specifically. I mean, all the money goes into corn and soy. More corn and soy, Roundup Ready soy, BT corn, or now Roundup Ready corn, and essentially what we're using GM to do is to allow farms to monocultures to get even bigger. One of the mysteries of genetic engineering, and you should ask Ron and Pam Ronald about it, is that, you know, if you read the back page ads of Monsanto, they talk about, you know, we need genetic engineering to increase the yield because we have a fixed land base, 10 billion people coming, we need GE to increase yield. That sounds good, but look at the history. The history of GE, they've been at it for 20 years. They have not increased yield. That's not what they do. Ask a farmer, and they will say, no, it's not about increased yield. What it's about is, I can handle more land because I don't have to do the three sprayings of herbicide. I can handle more land because if there's an outbreak of European corn borer over there, I'm covered. I don't even have to pay attention to it because the plant will put out the pesticide. So the thing to be careful about, and this is what I would have talked to Stuart about, is that a lot of GE is being sold to us based on a future promise that I don't even think they're working on. We are being sold a pig in a poke, with to use a farmer expression, that I don't even understand. I meant to Google that. What is a poke? What?
It's a bag.
A bag.
It's a bag. Thank you. Okay. It's the right analogy. We're being sold genetically modified seed in a poke. You know, if Monsanto is really serious about using its crops to solve problems, they won't be working on basically what are essentially Band-Aids on monocultures. So, I think we talk altogether too much about it. Mm-hmm. I think it gets way too much attention, and that's why I didn't talk about it. But the increases in yield we have seen over the last 20 years have all been from conventional breeding, which is withering on the vine because it doesn't get support. But there, we can solve these problems with conventional breeding. So I'm not raising alarms about the health risks. I'm not even raising alarms about the environmental risks, although there are some. What I'm suggesting is that this is really a very good business for a small handful of companies, and that the real key to genetic engineering is control of intellectual property of the food crops that we depend on. This is why they do it. And if we had open source genetic engineering, if we had genetic engineering that was really being applied to making the system more sustainable rather than more brittle, which is essentially what it's doing, I'm open to learning about it. It's possible. I mean, maybe you can figure out a way to increase the photosynthetic efficiency of plants. But the other thing I would insist on, besides open source for the intellectual property, is freedom to study it. And one of the real, Monsanto and these companies say that this is the most... See, you got me started on this. Sorry. I do have a lot to say about it. This is the most studied, most regulated food in history. Mm-hmm. The fact is that you, as an independent scientist, are not allowed to study a Monsanto product. Right. You are simply forbidden. And if you want to do a test on the environmental or health implications of genetically modified soy or corn or whatever, you must sign a contract that gives Monsanto prior approval before you can publish. Mm-hmm. And just 2 months ago, crop scientists around the world signed a letter saying, we can't study this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we need the ability to, really shine the light of science on this thing and not let Monsanto control all that information. So those are my objections. By the way, Stuart, if you want to read an alternative point of view, Stuart's new book has two very... powerful, but completely wrong-headed chapters on this. But they're well worth reading. They will focus the mind.
Stuart's book will be out in October, and he will actually be giving a Long Now seminar on his book in October, so come back in October. This is a question from Cameo Wood. As a beekeeper, I am constantly asked by farmers to put hives on their pesticide treated farms. My bees die and they hire new beekeepers. How can I help farmers break this cycle?
Yeah, well, the bee issue is very alarming. We've been talking about the system being unsustainable for a long time, and the question of where the breakdown would occur, who knows? And it probably will happen in some very unpredictable way. It might be the loss of cheap fossil fuel, but it might be the collapse of the honeybees, on which we depend for, 1 in 3 of every of bites of food we take. The problem with the bees is basically is a monoculture problem. A lot of people think that the source of this honeybee disease, that so many of them are, this colony die-off, has to do with the fact that the bees are spending time on pesticide-soaked fields, but more important, they're all coming to California every February to pollinate the almond harvest, the almond crop. Every Valentine's Day, 75% of the beehives in America are driven across country to the Central Valley because there are so many almonds there, and every blossom, every almond you eat needs to be pollinated by a honeybee, and there simply are not enough honeybees in the Central Valley. Why? Because there's nothing to eat for 50 weeks of the year. Why would they hang out? So they have to bring them in. And this practice only began in the 70s when, it was $10 to rent a box of bees. Now it's $150 to rent a box of bees. That's how critical the need is. So that you have people waking up bees in New England, driving them across country. Get this, to get them in shape, they give them high fructose corn syrup. I'm not kidding. We are giving bees high fructose corn syrup so they will be, sturdy enough to attack the almond crop. And since we're bringing bees from all over the country and increasingly all over the world, because we didn't have enough bees 3 years ago, so the USDA allowed them to import bees from Australia, who had a new set of diseases that American bees hadn't been exposed to. We mix them all up, and the beekeepers call it the Great Bee Bordello in the Central Valley. So, you know, we need to plant bee habitat where we have our crops. You know, if you're going to be growing almonds, you know, a certain percentage of your land has to be devoted to, you know, wildflowers or whatever the bees want to stay healthy for the rest of the year.
So one of the things that's very evident these days is that more and more China and other countries like India are having a larger effect on the world in terms of whatever it is that we want to count, whether it's pollution or generation of gases or even economic. Are there other countries of the world, and this is a question from Michael M., whose functioning, the modern functioning agricultural systems that are doing a good job that you think are worth looking at? So is China doing anything that we should be paying attention to, or is it things that we shouldn't be doing? Are they imitating us?
Yeah.
So how does this fit into the global view?
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say, I have not worked on the global question that hard, mm-hmm. so I'm speaking more from what I've read than what I've seen. By and large, other countries are following our lead because we, you know, we've basically insisted they do that. Free trade has been, by and large, in agriculture, a process of breaking down local agriculture mm-hmm. systems so that we go to Africa and we say, if you want to renegotiate your debt, part of structural adjustment is no more grain reserve. Grain reserves are very powerful tools for a government to keep food prices from getting too high or too low. And that was something I didn't mention, but we need to bring back grain reserves. The grain traders hate it because they lose the ability to speculate, but it's probably very important. We go to a country like Malawi and we say, no, you can't give fertilizer subsidies to your people anymore. That's market distorting. So we have countries that have been pretty good at feeding themselves and that we have insisted that they throw themselves on the mercy of global, you know, grain markets. And I think that we learned last summer that probably was a mistake. And the emphasis is moving the other direction. The World Bank is encouraging countries to once again build up their indigenous ability to feed themselves. I don't know that I can point to countries. There are really great examples in many countries of sustainable growing. The example I cited from Argentina is very mm-hmm. interesting, although that is gradually being disassembled for complicated reasons. That have nothing to do with its effectiveness, but just the policies. The government makes so much money on soy exports. They get 35% of the soy exports that they're encouraging farmers to just do soy every year. China is not a good model. I mean, China has polluted their soil to such a great extent that there are very high levels of heavy metals in their food. There, I would not trust any product called organic. From China. I don't think they really know what organic means. And I say that because my students have gone to report on it and, you know, bought the strawberries off the organic farms and had them tested and found them full of prohibited pesticides. China has polluted so much of its land, in fact, that they're buying land all over Africa now. They realize, they're looking ahead. I mean, they're taking a longer view than we are. They're looking ahead and they say, we don't have enough land to feed our people. So we're going to buy the best agricultural land in Africa, which will be really popular in Africa.
There's a question from Don Taffler. Does your big agricultural system encourage the use of recycled water, municipal wastewater, treated to Title ZZ standards? So in kind of urban farming, I suppose,
yeah.
is the role of water and water use and recycling municipal gray water, does that...
Yeah, it's very important. It's illegal in a lot of places, you know, to recycle gray water. But if we're going to have an explosion of home gardens, we have to figure out systems to allow that. Otherwise, you know, it will be unsustainable, at least in California. I mentioned Will Allen. His system in Milwaukee has an ingenious water angle, which is that he's growing fish, these golden perch, and he grows them in tanks in these unheated greenhouses. They're essentially heated by the compost piles. There's one in each corner. That's enough heat. And the wastewater from the fish, they produce their waste, filters down. That water is brought around, and that water then goes to the plants. feeds the plants, gives them all the nitrogen they need. They essentially clean the water by taking up the nitrates, and then the water comes back clean to the fish. So it's a closed-loop system, and we can design those systems. I mean, permaculture, this is what I'm describing as permaculture, has is always very sensitive to the water issue. But we simply need to, we don't price water properly to make people take care of it. Most of the water we're wasting is it's not, your teenager's long shower is one thing, but it's the alfalfa crop in California, basically. Right. I mean, it's 25% of the water in California goes to grow this low-value, water-hungry crop that then goes to feed dairy cattle living in a desert.
So you've in some ways pinpointed the root of the disease and the sickness for the food system as being cheap energy, cheap fossil fuel.
And cheap water, we should add.
What if we had cheap energy of a different type? What if there was cheap nuclear energy? Is it the fact that it's cheap that's the problem, or is it the fact that it's cheap and fossil fuel?
Well, I don't know how much... that's a good question. I mean, in terms of the climate effect, it's because it's fossil fuel that we're burning.
Right, I understand that.
And we're turning it into things like fertilizer, which, release nitrous oxide.
But if it was cheap nuclear fuel, would we be eating nukes instead of eating oil?
But I don't know how you would use that. When you talk about nuclear fuel, you're talking about electricity.
Yeah.
And that's not an important input in agriculture. It might be in food processing, I suppose. And yeah, if we put the whole grid on electric, nuclear-fueled electric trucks for our, we would definitely, that would definitely cut down on the carbon footprint of our food. But most of the carbon footprint of our food has to do with the fertilizers, which I don't see how the nukes help you with that. And you could squeeze the transportation part out, but I think that's probably about it.
Okay. So here's we haven't said anything controversial. Here's a question from Keith Borg. How does hunting fit into your idea of sustainable food?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think hunted meat is some of the most sustainable meat you can eat. We haven't talked that much about meat eating, but as I've kind of suggested, if you want to do one thing to reduce your carbon footprint, cut down on meat consumption. I mean, nothing is more produces more fossil fuel that you do than eating lots of meat. And I think the idea of a meatless Monday, there's a movement to start a meatless Monday, is a terrific idea. Because it's something we could all do. It doesn't seem that hard. I mean, we can't have a day without driving for many of us. We can't have a day without heating your house. But we could have a day without eating meat. That seems eminently doable. And it's the equivalent of taking 20 million cars off the road. 20 million mid-sized sedans, if everybody did it. Hunted meat is solar-produced meat, right? I mean, nobody's fertilizing the food that the deer are eating or the wild boar, and we have a surfeit of this meat. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we need to appreciate what hunters can bring to the table.
So you mentioned politics. Here's a question from Terry Mosley. Can you tell us more about the folks that have been put in charge of the Department of Agriculture in the current administration? Are they any good? Would you prefer different people?
Well, Tom Vilsack is the Secretary of Agriculture, and when he was first appointed, I gave a kind of, cranky and temperate response in an interview, and I said, agribusiness as usual. He was governor of Iowa, very close to the biotech industry, had done some things in Iowa that weren't that helpful. But he surprised me and a lot of other people since he's taken office. He's talked a lot about local food. He's talked a lot about farmers markets. He's very committed to building farmers markets in this country and speaks about them with a passion that comes from the heart. And he really understands that farmers markets are not just about food, they're about community. It's become a very important kind of new public square in America. So he will promote that. He has, as I said, he's hired as his number two, Kathleen Merrigan, and I think that's incredibly helpful. And already she's, started a program where we have something called EQIP funds, which is money that in the farm bill that goes to basically helping feedlots clean up their waste. We pay, they produce the waste, we pay them to clean it up. That some of those funds now can be used to help farmers transition to organic. And that's a radical new idea. So I'm encouraged by, you know, some of the things that are happening. He's really up against it. And the industry, you know, he made a move on subsidies in the budget where they tried to cut subsidies to farmers grossing more than $500,000 a year. And he depicted it as, you know, taking money from rich farmers and giving it to hungry children, which is a really not helpful way to describe it. Because first of all, they weren't rich farmers. I mean, the problem with this industry I'm describing is it's so capital intensive that you could have $500,000 in gross sales and be making $40,000. It was kind of not well thought out, and it was promptly dropped. And he unified the farm bloc against him. But I do think that there is pressure mounting, and that they feel that there is pressure. But it's important to understand, I think, that it won't happen. You know, I read that quote from Obama, and he gets it. And it's not enough to elect someone who gets it. Getting it is not the same as doing anything about it. And Obama has actually said, you know, privately to people he's talked to about these issues, you know, I don't see enough of a movement yet to move on these food questions. Show me the movement. He's used those words, which FDR used also in another context. Show me the movement. And what he means is that, you know, there is such opposition to change. The system works so well for such powerful companies that he's going to need a lot of people at his back. And there's a story told about Bill Clinton in 1993 when he had his first budget negotiation.
Sorry to cut that off. We have come to the end of Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wander Fox, and you're tuned into 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and freakradio.org. And you've been listening to Michael Pollan speaking about deep agriculture. If you would like to hear that talk in its entirety, you can find a link to it on my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show. If you go to Facebook, it's Your Homegrown Food Show. And thank you so much for tuning in. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week. You can tune in to Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday at 11:30. And I wish you all a happy Wednesday. And we'll go on to Democracy Now!